Somehow it fell off of my shirt. Okay, yeah. Well, I really appreciate you welcoming Michael Gillen. He talked to me this past week and said you guys really treated him well. He loved the questions, the discussion. He especially was excited just how people really are engaging one another after class. So he says, please tell the class it was a great experience that he had here. So, and, he's one of our visiting scholars. We've had about 60 scientists go through our program. He was with us for a month. And I don't know what kind of introduction you got with Michael, but he was the science correspondent for ABC News for 15 years. He's also produced several full-length movies. And as you probably figured out, he's a really gifted speaker. So, and we basically brought him in to try to help our scientists communicate their knowledge in a more productive way. If you know anything about scientists, they're typically not great communicators. And so having Michael come in, we actually got several good interviews, and hopefully he's going to have a good impact on our scientists and help them be able to communicate, not just to one another, but to lay people. So, and then Mark Perez stepped in afterwards. That was great. And so thank you. Allowed me to do what I did over there in England. And what was fun about going to England was actually meeting some people that participate through virtual media. So, yeah, guy from Poland I got to meet. So, if you're not aware, we literally have people around the world that participate in this class. And so, yeah, if you walk in front of the camera, you will be broadcast. And now we're getting that adjusted a little bit. Okay. Quick report on what happened in London, then we'll jump into the lesson. And yeah, the lesson's going to be a little bit different today because I came with all kinds of fantastic visuals to show you as part of our teaching material. And as you can see, I wasn't able to make a connection. Both of my connectors have failed. So next week, assuming I can get this fixed, I will show you that great visual stuff. Quickly, what happened, and we were doing a conference in London, and we had this conference scheduled literally for the past 9 months, and it turns out it was on the exact same day as the royal wedding. So, same day, same time. So I was asking the people who organized the conference for us, is this going to affect the attendance any? And they said, not for the people that are coming to this conference. The vast majority don't even know there is a wedding going on. So we actually did wind up with a slightly larger audience than they've had at previous conferences. We're running around about 650 participants, which makes it the biggest apologetics conference in all of the United Kingdom. And again, the sessions are all going to be put online, so you can actually look at everything that was done there. Everything was audio and video recorded. And then during the week, I spent a day at a TV and radio studio, interviewed several times, but probably the most significant part was the hour and 15-minute long debate I had with Peter Atkins. How many of you have ever taken college chemistry? Okay. If you've taken college chemistry, the one for science students, you probably took Peter Atkins' textbook. He's the, you remember Peter Atkins? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a challenging textbook, but a very good textbook, and literally universities around the world use that. But he's been a lifelong atheist, and so and he's debated many Christians. In fact, if you Google his name or go on YouTube, you can see all kinds of debates he's done with Christian leaders from around the world. So, but I really appreciated Justin Brierley. He moderated the debate between us, and I loved the way he started it and the way he ended it. Because, I watched a few of the debates that Peter had with other Christians, and what I noticed is his rationale or reason for being an atheist never really came out. They just kind of jumped right into it. But Justin, that's how he started things off. He says, and Justin was kind of aware that one of the debate tactics of Peter's is to say to the Christian, Well, of course, you believe this because that's how you're raised. And so he decided to start the debate right off by saying, Hugh, please tell us your background. And that's kind of what helped, because I was not raised in a Christian home. And, you know, came to Christ through my science, which really surprised Peter, that it was science that brought me to faith in Christ. Then he turned to Peter and said, what about you? What made you an atheist? And for the first time, what came out is the fact that he was raised in an Anglican, and his parents forced him to go to these different Anglican services, and, as he put it, basically jammed religion down my throat. And so as soon as he started to study science, he said, I'm having nothing to do with this. And this is so typical. I mean, almost every atheist scientist I've debated over the past few decades has had a bad experience with church. It's like this idea that they become an atheist independent of church, that doesn't seem to be the case, at least 80%. And it's always interesting that it's always a bad experience. I saw this with the particle physicist Victor Stenger after the debate I had with him at Caltech. I said, well, he told me, look, I'm familiar with Christianity. I was raised a Christian. And he said, well, tell me more. And he says, well, I was an altar boy in a Catholic church. I said, well, tell me about that. He says, I can't. There was a very painful experience for him. He just says, no, I can't talk about it. So I have a quite typical. Richard Dawkins, likewise, had a really bad experience in church when he was 13. And so there's kind of a bitterness there you have to deal with. So, and I love the way Justin ended the debate, too. Because, you know, most of the debate was focusing on, you know, can the origin of life be explained without God? And, you know, Peter Atkins, being a chemist, he thought, and I says, well, he says, it's a done deal. We got it all figured out. And I says, well, that's not what I hear at origin of life conferences. It's quite the opposite, is that it's getting more and more intractable with each conference. And I was tempted to say, and by the way, I've never seen you in any of these origin of life conferences, but I didn't do that. So, but yeah, it was clear he wasn't up on the literature. And so the debate went back and forth on, you know, the Bible, Big Bang cosmology, origin of life. Are humans really exceptional? And if you want to listen or watch, the debate was both video and audio recorded, and it's going up on the British television, but we will get a link. So as soon as I get a link, I'll give you that link. But I love the way that Justin ended it. He says, well, we spent an hour talking about the evidences. And he says, Hugh, what would it take scientifically for you to abandon your Christian worldview and walk over to Peter's side? And I says, well, if you were to show me beyond any reasonable doubt scientifically that we human beings are no different than the plants and the animals, there's nothing exceptional about us, we're not distinct in any way, I said, that would be catastrophic to my Christian faith. And if you could show me the universe never had a beginning, and there was no creator for the universe, that would be catastrophic to my Christian faith. Or if you can show me that Jesus of Nazareth didn't rise bodily from the dead. And by the way, that's right in the book of Corinthians, where Paul says, if that didn't happen, we are to be pitied amongst all men because we believe a lie and we're dead in our sins. You got one of those? That might actually work. Okay, let's see. Well, it's right here. We'll get that on. Maybe one of you can. Here we go. And let's get this one on.
You, when you said television, you mean to the public? This is going to be.
Yeah, it's radio and TV. It's called Premier. It's Premier TV, Premier Radio. It's a. So.
Christian?
Justin Brierley is a Christian. He never lets people know that he's a Christian. He's a very fair moderator. But his show is basically where he has a Christian and an atheist debate one another on a topic. And it's not always a scientist. He often has philosophers, theologians, and so on, do that kind of thing.
Is Premier Radio and TV a Christian network?
It is. and it broadcasts throughout the United Kingdom, Netherlands, Belgium, parts of Canada. So, and we will get the online link, so I'll be able to give you the link once it's available. But yeah, I love the way he ended it, saying, okay, Hugh, what would it take for you to abandon your Christian faith? Then he turned to Peter Atkins and said, what would it take you scientifically to abandon your atheism and become a follower of Jesus Christ? And he basically said, there is no evidence that would ever cause me to change my position. And he said, well, for the last hour, Justin jumped in at the very end. He said, the last hour we're talking about how we have to base our case on evidence. And now you're saying no amount of evidence would ever cause you to change your position. That's how the debate ended. So, yeah, but, you know, Peter is also part of the British Humanist Association. So that probably explains what's going on there. Hey, I'm actually going to be able to show you some stuff here. This is great. Okay. Well, maybe not. Let's see if I can actually get this up and running. Come on. Okay. I thought I had this worked up. Let me make sure everything's connected here. Okay, that's connected. Now two, this should work. Up at the projector? No, it's on. Well, maybe you can figure this out. Okay, while we're trying to get that up and running. Okay. Harry, let the service dog come in now. Okay. What I hope to be able to share with you is a paper that got published just this past Wednesday in the British journal Nature, which is considered to be the most prestigious science journal in the world. And it's basically a study trying to determine the date in which shales began to form. And the significant part there is that's the signal for the formation of continents. So if you've got water falling on kind of the land masses, and that's being eroded in the oceans, you get shales. And so what they did is they looked at 290 different shale sites around the world, dated the shale sites, and basically for the first time performed triple oxygen isotope analysis. So what's going on there? Well, they looked at oxygen 18, oxygen 17, and oxygen 16. And previously, researchers had done studies on oxygen 18 to 16, but never included 17. And it's based on the old studies that they were able to determine the dates for the building up of the continents. And based on what they did years ago, they were able to determine that the buildup of continental land masses looked a particular way, and this is where I need to show the slide. Okay. Tell you what, why don't I put this to sleep and put this back up and see if that will work. Hopefully it didn't crash my computer. Uh-oh. All right. Okay. So, looking just at oxygen 16 to 18 ratios of the shales around the world, this is work that was done, 10, 15 years ago. They were able to determine that this is the history of the buildup of the continental land masses. And it basically is in sync with what you see in Genesis chapter 1, where it talks about Earth beginning as a water world. Genesis 1, 2, water covers the whole surface of the Earth. And so what we see here is that you begin indeed as a water world, then you get tiny volcanic islands, and then plate tectonics kicks in, and you can see these shales giving the signature that you have aggressive continental landmass buildup when the Earth is about 2 billion years old, and then it gradually increases thereafter. Now, Genesis 1 puts the formation of the continents at the beginning of creation day 3. So you got 6 days of creation, beginning of creation day 3, and notice that the timing here is consistent, basically telling us that a little less than half of the Earth's current age, we have this dramatic buildup of continental land masses. Okay, this new research basically changes this graph. And so this is what the new graph looks like. Yeah, basically saying, and that's the title of the paper, Rapid Emergence of Continents. Go back one. Okay, so that's what we thought the buildup of continental landmass history was a week ago. And then now, thanks to this paper, we realize it needs to be adjusted. It's roughly the same, but this is now done with much more precision. So this is very accurately determined, thanks to the fact that they did a study with 3 oxygen isotopes, not just 2. But it shows that there's a much more dramatic emergence of continents than we thought just a week ago. And it's kind of the wording you see in Genesis chapter 1, that, you know, beginning of creation day 3, we see this rapid emergence of continental land masses all over the Earth. Now, what's really fun is that their study was sufficiently detailed, they're actually able to determine what the continents looked like before this great jump up and what it looked like after, and also what they determined to be the cause of this. And so here's the map that they produce, and you can see it in their paper. So that's kind of the before and after. And you say, what's the time scale separating those two events? Less than 130 million years. When I shared that with my wife, she said, that's really a long time. I said, well, not if you're looking at 4,562 million years. This is really just a brief whisper of time. By the way, it's that or less. But notice, you go from just a small amount of continental landmass to continents being almost as big as they are today. Incidentally, they got a name for that supercontinent. It's Kenora Land. It's the first of the supercontinents that showed up. And what you see thereafter is basically the supercontinent cycle, where planet Earth goes from having one big continent where it splits into small continents, and it comes back together into one big continent and splits up into continents and then comes back together again. There's been 6 cycles of the supercontinent, the last one being Pangaea. I bet you everybody here has heard of Pangaea, right? Okay, well, Pangaea is the last one. That was 250 million years ago, and this is Kenora Land, which showed up about 2.2 million years ago. Yes? Well, it's because of the way plate tectonics kicks in. And you need life to really keep the plate tectonics going. So it's no accident that the origin of life is the same date as the origin of plate tectonics. Yeah, and the first, I mean, you get a couple of small volcanic islands, and the first thing you see is what they call a single craton. Craton's a word for a small continent. And so you get this one small craton. And then you get 2, and by the way, the 2 you get are basically Western Australia and South Africa. Those are the 2 first continental land masses to form. They still exist today. In fact, if you look at this map over here, notice Australia hasn't changed much over the past 2.4 billion years. It's basically the same. And incidentally, it shows you there the first of the continental land. So the little craton in Western Australia is equivalent to what you see here in South Africa. So you get 2 small ones, and then it really begins to kick in explosively. Now, the thing you notice here is they show some shaded parts here. That's basically stuff that's below sea level, but not a whole lot below sea level. So, like, there may be only 100 or 200 feet of sea above those spots, and so it only needs a little bit of tectonic activity to push them above the surface of the water. So here you've got a lot of potential continents that are not yet above sea level, and suddenly they're all pushed up there. Yes?
In lay language, how can they make that map that happened 2.5 billion years ago?
Okay, what they did is they went into 290 shale boreholes. So looked at shale all around the world. In fact, they basically said in their paper, we went to all seven continents, found shale in all seven continents, different places, and they're able to date the shales and able to determine that the shales appeared explosively. That's what the addition of oxygen 17 did. With oxygen 18, they kind of get a temperature change, and the temperature change tells us. Basically, this is the same time that the temperature of the Earth drops by a big factor. And they basically said, well, the reason why it's dropping by a big factor, you're getting the formation of these continents. And they were able to determine that with oxygen 18. Oxygen 18 gave them the temperature change over the history. But it wasn't able to give them the detail that you get here. It's the addition of the oxygen 17 isotope that told them it was an explosive event, not a gradual event, and was sufficiently dramatic that you actually get a really big supercontinent, Kenora-land. So yeah, they're able to come up with this detailed map. The yellow stuff is basically the new formation. The orange material is stuff that would have formed first. It formed first. The other thing that they were also able to determine was this is the first time you get mountain ranges. And so what you got here are basically little small continents or cratons that are like 1,000 feet above sea level or less. But as you move into Kenora land, you actually get big mountain ranges showing up. So, yes?
So is this all pretty much due to volcanism?
That's basically due to the plate tectonic activity. So volcanism is a part of plate tectonics.
Wouldn't that raise the temperature, the atmosphere?
Well, what's happening is that, this is coinciding what's called the Great Oxygenation Event. And so there's a wholesale change in the chemistry of the Earth and a wholesale change in the tectonics. This is something that I've written about in Improbable Planets. If you want the details, they're in there. What this new paper is basically telling us is that it's much more explosive than what we thought. Rather than being something that was gradually occurring over 500 million years, it's really taking place over just 100 million years. And rather than we're seeing the continental landmass go from 5% up to 20%, it goes from 2% up to 27%. So it's a much more...
And we're at 33% now?
Right now we're at 29%. So yes, since this event, we've only increased the continental landmass coverage by 2%. And before that, it was 2% or less. So literally went from 2% to 27%. Or to put it another way, the increase in continental landmass between this figure and that figure is 12 or 13 times. So in a very short window of time, the continental landmass is increased by 12 to 13 times.
And when did the Americas start forming?
Well, one of those mountain ranges is the Appalachians. I'm not sure which one it is, but one of those is the Appalachians. So, yes.
Didn't we have ice and water, the three forms?
How we did, the great oxygenation event, because when you pump oxygen in the atmosphere, it pulls carbon dioxide and especially methane out of the atmosphere. Those are powerful greenhouse gases, and so that caused the temperature of the Earth to plummet so much it initiated huge ice ages. And not ice ages like we've been having the last couple of million years. They're having what they call snowball or slush ball events. Say, what's the slush ball event? Well, a snowball event is when more than 90% of the planet is covered with thousands of feet of ice. A slush ball event is where it's more than 80%. And so you get kind of like a little thin line around the equator where it's not frozen over, but everywhere else it is. But yeah, there were several big slush ball and snowball events that took place when the oxygen jumped up. And by the way, the oxygen jump, they call it the great oxygenation event. It's when the oxygen content in the atmosphere goes from 1/10,000th of a percent up to 2%. Okay, today it's 21%, but that the next big oxygenation event is what happened at the Cambrian explosion, and that's where it jumped from 1% up to 8%, then 10%, and 20%. Those are called minor oxygenation events. This first one is called the great oxygenation event. You say, gee, it's only 2%. Yeah, but they're looking at the number of decimals. You're going from 1/10,000 of a percent up to 2%, so that's like 5 orders of magnitude greater oxygen in the atmosphere, and that had a dramatic impact on the chemistry of the atmosphere and paved the way for what we call eukaryotic life forms. Say, what kind of life forms are those? Those are life forms where the cells have a nucleus. They got a Golgi apparatus in there. Basically, you're getting complex cells, which enables complex life to come into existence. Yes, Doug. Well, like the, yeah, I mean, if you look in kind of like eastern South Africa, there's a craton there that dates back before this time. Okay, so and likewise in Western Australia, there's a craton that dates before this time. Okay.
I know mankind came from the Africa area, the Red Sea or whatever.
Well, prokaryotic life has been around for 3.825 billion years. That's life based on cells that don't have a central nucleus. But this event led to the emergence of more complex cellular life. So, okay. Any other questions before we jump into the lesson? Anyway, I'm going to be writing a blog on this. It'll be out in the middle of June. I write a blog every week on some new scientific discovery. And incidentally, there's actually a second paper I'll talk to you about next week, which actually identifies, affirms what happened on creation day 4. So yeah, in 1 week, we have these two papers that give us stunning new affirmation of what Genesis 1 has been claiming for thousands of years. Isn't this a wonderful time to be alive? Okay, go ahead, John.
Curiosity question, if you can speculate. What, on the Richter scale, what kind of earthquakes were occurring in this explosion of land?
Well, that's difficult to say, John, because there were no seismographs around there to measure it. I mean, we do know that the tectonic activity was much stronger back then than it is today. However, tectonics is complicated. Sometimes you get plates moving against one another where you get thousands of small movements of the earth that hardly anybody notices what's happening. Other times the plates get locked, but there's stress there that builds up, and then suddenly it shifts like this, and you get a massive earthquake. What we do know is that there was plenty of tectonic activity going on back then, more so than today. But exactly what kind of tectonics, we don't have the seismographs to tell you. So, I mean, volcanoes are part of that as well. But, you know, so plates can move slowly, and then they can lock and cause big earthquakes.
It's probably safe to say you wouldn't want to be here.
Well, I'll give you an example. If you go a little bit north here in California, you run into something called the Pinnacles. Any of you ever been to the Pinnacles? Okay, a few of you have, okay. The Pinnacles is a mountain range here in California that sits right on top of the San Andreas Fault. And it actually split this mountain range into two pieces. And so one side of the mountain went this way, the other side went this way. Guess how far apart they are today? More than 200 miles apart from one another. But they call them the Pinnacles because the San Andreas Fault literally sheared the mountain range right in the middle. So you got a cliff face on this side and a cliff face on this side. So you got a gradual incline up, and it just sharply drops down.
And a matching side.
Yeah, matching side. So you actually put the two pieces together, you can fit them in like kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. But most of that movement was not as a result of big earthquakes. Most of the movement was a result of just having lots of little movements taking place gradually over time and literally pushing those two pieces of the mountain apart from one another by more than 200 miles. Hey, if you've never been to the Pinnacles, it's a great place to go because, yeah, you just see this gradual climb up, and then you just kind of get a cliff face on the other side. It's fun to climb up and kind of look out over the valley. And it's only 2,000 feet high, so fun place to go. Okay. Yes. One more comment? No? Okay. Let me exit this and pull up our lesson in Isaiah. Oh, and one thing I was able to do for you is all of Isaiah passages that speak about the cosmic beginning. I actually typed them all up here, so you got this nice little collection. Unfortunately, this morning, the toner on my printer ran out. So I've got maybe 12 copies here. That's it. It's two pages. Next week, I'll bring enough for all of you. But you might want to share, and if someone can find a photocopier, we could actually get some for all of you. So that's a list of all the scriptures. And for those of you who are new here to the class, kind of what we did, we spent 15 minutes in the class, breaking up into small groups of four each, and we went through the entire book of Isaiah and gathered up all the verses that pertain to the beginning of the universe and wound up with about 30 verses that we whittled down to about 24 verses, and those are the passages. And yeah, it's two pages, by the way, so you're going to need two pages. But these are the passages we wound up with after we edited out a few. And now we're kind of going through these texts and basically seeing what they got to say about the beginning of the universe. And we're spending some time on this because of all the books of the Bible, the book of Isaiah says the most about the beginning of the universe. Now, of course, there's a famous passage in Genesis 1:1, Hebrews 11:3, Jeremiah jumps into this, the book of Job jumps into this, but Isaiah gives the most complete description of the beginning of the universe. And I'm going to just rapidly go through the ones we've already covered, and then we'll kind of slow down when we get to the ones we haven't covered yet. Okay, begins in Isaiah 6:3. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. His glory fills the whole earth, namely every part of God's creation reveals God's glory. None of it is wasted. Every one of it communicates something about the glory of God. And actually, we're going to look at passages to talk about how every component actually tells something about his plan of salvation. Isaiah 14:24, the Lord of hosts has sworn, as I have purposed, so it will be, as I have planned it, so it will happen. Bottom line, there are no accidents or random outcomes. Every outcome and event in the history of the universe has a purpose, and we need to look for that. This is actually something we discussed in the debate I had with Peter Atkins, because he was trying to make the claim that, hey, most of what we see in the universe has no purpose, no benefit, no value. And so I was able to challenge him on that and say, no, I think everything we see in the universe has purpose, has value, has a plan. We just need to look for it. It's not gratuitous. Isaiah 14:27, the Lord of hosts himself has planned it. Therefore, who can stand in its way? It is his hand that is outstretched, so who can turn it back? And nothing stands in the way of God's purposes and plans. Isaiah does talk about that supernatural being who's opposed to God's plans, but it's basically making the point not even Satan has any capacity to stop God's plans and purposes in creation. Isaiah 37:16, the Lord of hosts, God of Israel, who is enthroned above the cherubim, you are God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You made the heavens and the earth. God is the only agency of creation. There's no other factor. Notice the reference to the cherubim. An excellent cross-reference here is Hebrews 1, because in the book of Hebrews, the author of Hebrews is basically addressing this idea that the angels were with God and partners with him in creation. Incidentally, you'll still see a footnote in Jewish Bibles to that effect in Genesis 1, because there's a text in Genesis 1 referring to God creating humans where it says, let us create them, male and female. And they said, well, the reference to us and to we, that's the angels. And so God's not the only agency in creation. The angels are involved. That's basically how Jews get around the fact that the Old Testament appears to teach the doctrine of the Trinity. But notice Isaiah here is saying the cherubim. The cherubim are the highest angels, and he says, no, God sits above them. Only God is involved in creation. Yes, John? Right. Well, this text is consistent with that.
How do they get around that one?
Well, I mean, as you know, we've had some Jews participating here in the class, and the big debate is, okay, where do you Christians get this doctrine of the Trinity? And what we're going to see in our study of Isaiah, the Old Testament teaches the doctrine of the Trinity more explicitly and extensively than the New Testament does. But that's something that Jews really struggle accepting. Because Jewish theology is that God is one and only one, one person, not three persons. And so they have to deny what it says there in Genesis 1 and say, well, yeah, it's not that God is two persons or three persons, it's the angels. But this text is making it say, nope, the angels aren't part of it. Hebrews chapter 1 goes into that more explicitly. Only God himself is able to create. God is the only agency of creation. Interesting. I mean, we probably remember some of the discussion we had with Jews who were here in the class. If you look at Genesis 1, the only word it uses for God in Genesis 1 is Elohim. Interesting word for God basically means the one who is singular and plural, the uniplural one. And there's the doctrine of the Trinity right there in the first sentence of the Bible. And in case you don't miss the point, when it talks about the creation of human beings, God uses the singular pronoun and he uses the plural pronoun. Back-to-back sentences. One sentence uses singular pronouns, the other sentence uses a plural pronoun. So right up off the bat, but we're going to see here in the book of Isaiah, it identifies the Holy Spirit as the creator of the universe, the Son as the creator of the universe, the Messiah, and the Father as the creator of the universe. And look how many times it tells in the book of Isaiah, there's only one creator. Three people are named as a creator, but there's only one creator. Okay, that's one of the study questions we'll get to. Moving on, Isaiah 45, the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all mankind together will see it, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. This is right out of the Handel's Messiah. Basically making the point, Handel included it in the Messiah, making the point God's glory is evident to everyone, all have heard. And so it's not just those who have been exposed to the Bible. If you've seen the sky at night, you have seen God's glory. And that's why it tells us in Romans, everyone is without excuse. Everyone's been exposed to God's revelation through nature, the book of nature. Isaiah 40:12, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or marked out the heavens, sorry for the typo there, with the span of his hand? Who has gathered the dust of the earth in a measure? Making the point that even a speck of dust, even a single drop of water, is purposed, determined, and measured by God. Now, if he's so fastidious about a single speck of dust, how much more do you think he cares about you as a human being? And so, basically, it's making the point, hey, even every speck of dust, every drop of water, is measured by God. And somebody, when I went over this a couple of weeks ago, said, how much water is there in the universe? Well, there's a lot of water in the universe. A lot of dust in the universe. It's very dusty and it's very wet. I made the point that water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe, right after hydrogen 2 and hydrogen 3. And so the universe is soaking wet, which is kind of ironic when you have NASA saying, we need to follow the water, because where we find water, we're going to find life. Well, you're going to find water everywhere. In fact, the Earth-like planets we're finding have way too much water, 500 to 1,000 times more water than the Earth. And if you got that much water, that discovery I talked about earlier wouldn't happen. The continents would never break the surface of the Earth. And one thing I did mention, by the way, in this discovery is that when the continents jump from just a very tiny percentage, 1 or 2% of the Earth, up to 27%, that set in motion the cycling of nutrients from the continents to the oceans and back to the continents. If that hadn't have happened, there'd be no advanced life on Earth. That nutrient recycling is crucial to sustain plants and animals. And so that was all set up at the great oxygenation event. Okay, Isaiah 40:22. This is where we ended up last time I was here. Very famous passage. God is enthroned above the circle of the earth. Its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like thin cloth and spreads them out like a tent to live in. So basically making a point, you know, God is able to take care of things here on earth. From a perspective so far away, we look like grasshoppers. And yeah, we got into a little discussion. I mean, we have a flat earth creationist trying to claim this text as proof that the earth is a circular disk. But hey, the whole point here, only a sphere looks like a circle from all perspectives above. And so this text is actually cited as one of the biblical texts supporting a spherical earth. It's not for a flat earth. Then we ended with, he stretches out the heavens like a thin cloth. He spreads them out like a tent to live in. This is the first of several passages we'll be looking at in Isaiah that speaks about the expansion of the universe. There are seven passages in Isaiah that use the verb natah with respect to the Hebrew verb natah with respect to the universe. Translated here, stretching out of the universe, the verb natah, if you look it up in the lexicon, really means the expansion of whatever is being described. And so it would actually be better translated, he expands the universe. But he expands it like a thin cloth and spreads them out like a tent to live in. Just this past week, while I was in London, I got all kinds of questions of both my Twitter page and my Facebook page saying, okay, I've heard that the universe is expanding. What is expanding into? Is it expanding into empty space? I had to explain to him, well, no, space only exists on the surface of the universe. And they said, well, what's this surface? Well, it's got three dimensions, not two. Help me visualize this, as I can't. Okay? You can only visualize dimensional properties in the dimensions you personally experience. But to give you an analogy, it's kind of like planet Earth. Earth has got three dimensions, and we humans live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. And so people also ask me a question, where is the center of the universe? And I said, well, that's like asking someone who's constrained to the surface of the Earth saying, where is the center of the Earth? If all you can access is the surface, nobody is at the center. Well, all the stars, galaxies, planets, moons, even the space-time dimensionality is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. And again, don't try to visualize it. It's something we can prove, but it's something we can't visualize. You say, gee, that's kind of inconvenient. Well, the universe is basically a four space-time dimensional system. And yeah, I mean, trying to visualize four dimensions geometrically can't be done. But it can be tackled with mathematics. I think I gave this example a couple years ago in the class about when I took a sophomore mathematics class in complex variables at the University of British Columbia. The professor showed us a video clip of a basketball in four dimensions of space being turned inside out. And the amazing thing is if you got four dimensions of space, you can turn that basketball inside out without making a single cut or slit in the surface of the basketball. Now, he didn't show it to us in four dimensions. He did kind of what a real estate agent does. He shows you your new home in two-dimensional slices from different perspectives. And that's what this clip did. It showed us the basketball being turned inside out in two dimensions from one perspective, another two dimensions, different perspective, another two dimensions. And so we said, hey, it definitely works. And then the professor had the audacity to say, okay, you got a week to prove it mathematically. That was our assignment for the week. So, it was a bit of a challenge, but we were able to determine, hey, this really happens if you got four dimensions. Now, if you want to really pack oranges close together, if you got 1 million independent dimensions of space, you can take spherical oranges and put them in a one-dimensional box where there's zero space between the oranges. That's a little more complicated math problem that you can take home and work on, okay? So strange things happen when you do that, and that's why I'm saying the universe has those strange features. However, this actually has apologetic value. Okay, if you're going to come up with a religion as a human being, you're going to write about that religion in a way that you can visualize with your mind. And notice that's the case with every holy book outside of the Bible. If you look at the Quran, everything it writes is something you can visualize from a human experience perspectives. Same thing with the Hindu Vedas. That's why their discussions about heaven, for example, are so different than what you see in the Bible. And this actually had a factor in my coming to faith in Jesus Christ, is realizing that this book we call the Bible contains things that we can't visualize from a human perspective, which was a clue to me that comes from a mind that can visualize those perspectives, someone from beyond the universe. The Trinity is one example. And this is one reason why Jews, for example, in their study of the Old Testament, reject the doctrine of the Trinity, because they're wanting to have a God that they can visualize. But God, being beyond the universe, has properties that can't be visualized. However, there are things we can prove that the text actually sustains. So both the New Testament and the Old Testament sustains a description about God that's impossible for us to visualize. And you've heard me say this before in a class, and I got a blog article on this. Science only makes sense if God is triune. So independent of the Bible, we can establish that God is a Trinity. And I've actually tried that on friends that are Muslims, basically saying, okay, if you trust science, notice that from an Islamic perspective, you wind up with a God that's contradicting what we can see revealed in science. But in Christianity, there is no contradiction. It fits because God is triune. Yes, Doug. Well, the wonderful thing about the physical sciences, we're confronted with all kinds of things that we can't visualize, what we know must be true. A good example is quantum mechanics. A lot of stuff in quantum mechanics. I mean, that's the thing. When you're teaching students physics and introducing the quantum mechanics, they say, okay, well, I'm going to understand quantum mechanics. I got to visualize all the phenomena going on here, saying that can't happen. If that's your goal, then you're going to have a real hard time passing this course. Just simply be satisfied with understanding that it's true. You don't have to be able to visualize it.
So it seems kind of arrogant for anybody to want to try to put God in a box like that, like some of the world's religions seem to want to do, right?
Well,
for even use that as arrogance, you know what I mean? Yeah.
That was evidence for me that the Vedas and the Quran, the writings of the Zoroastrians, the Buddhists, came from a human mind and were not inspired by the one that transcends the universe, because they showed the limitations of human visualization. Whereas the Bible has all kinds of doctrines that defy what we human beings can visualize. And yet we can show, just like with quantum mechanics, we can't visualize it, but we know it's true. Likewise with the universe. Okay, back to this thin cloth that spreads out like a tent to live in. Okay, lots of questions. Go ahead, sorry. Oh, one from the virtual audience. Great.
So, Eric from the live stream was asking, wanted to know, is the cosmic background radiation, would it look very similar if it was measured 45 billion light years away?
Okay, I think I get the question. And thank you, Eric. We always love participants from the virtual audience. Would the cosmic background radiation look any different if you're in a location, say, 45 million miles or light years away from where you are right now? Well, 45 million light years, that gets you about a third of the way to the Virgo supercluster, the center of the Virgo supercluster. And the basic answer is it would not look a whole lot different. I mean, there is some structure that we can see in the cosmic background radiation relative to the position in the sky. But the amazing thing about the cosmic background radiation, it's smooth to four orders of magnitude. I mean, yeah, we have these maps that show these hot spots and cold spots in the cosmic background radiation, but that's only because we're now able to make temperature measurements to one part in a million, actually able to make measurements of 1/1,000th of a degree. And there we can see some variation in the hot and cold spots of the cosmic background radiation. But I remember when we were first making these measurements, the map basically just showed one smooth color. We couldn't see any difference. It was the same temperature all the way across, but that's because we could only make temperature measurements to 1/10,000th of a degree. The COBE satellite was the first satellite in the late part of the 20th century that could make temperature measurements to 1/100,000th of a degree. And there they saw the subtle variations. Now we're down to better than one part in 1/1,000,000th of a degree. And so we see some detailed maps. I can pull one up here in the computer, but it would take too long. If you go to the Planck website, P-L-A-N-C-K, you'll see the best map that's been produced of the cosmic background radiation. But to answer the question, yeah, if you go far enough away from here, you'll see that the positions of the hot and cold spots have changed, but the map will look the same. It just kind of moves. It's kind of like, you know, looking at Canada from an airplane when you're over the west or the east. It's still Canada, but you get to have a little different perspective on it. So, but yeah, it's remarkably smooth. Okay, we had another question. Ah, okay. I thought he said billion, not million. Sorry. Okay. I think the question he's getting at is the universe is only 13.8 billion years old, but astronomers talk about the universe being many tens of billions of light years across, or even bigger, maybe even infinite. Well, there are different perspectives on this, but one thing we know for sure is that the universe that exists today must be a lot bigger than the universe we see through our telescopes. Because the universe we see through our telescopes, we're forced to look back in time. So for example, when we look at the sun, we see it as it was 8 minutes ago. We look at the Andromeda galaxy as it was 2.5 million years ago. And the universe is expanding, as this text here speaks about. And so if the universe is expanding, it's getting bigger and bigger as it gets older and older. And since the universe we see through the telescope, pardon me?
And it's accelerating.
And it's accelerating, yeah. It expands faster at a faster rate with every year that goes by.
It's going faster than the speed of light.
Well, it's very close to approaching the speed of light. And, that's another whole issue, is that we're right at the speed of light right now. In the future, the universe will expand so rapidly, we won't be able to see all the way back to the cosmic creation event. But yeah, you'd think that the universe, since we is only 13.8 billion years old, must be a maximum of 28 billion light years across. But in fact, it's much bigger than that because, the universe that we looked at, say, 10 billion light years away, is a universe very much smaller than the universe we see today. So the universe of today is bigger than the universe we see through the telescope. Or as I tell my wife all the time, since I'm an astronomer, I can't be held accountable for the present. I have no access to the present. I can only be held accountable for the past. So, right. So billions of years ago, I can tell you what was happening. But today, no, I really don't know what's going on. Okay. But there are also models of the universe where you, because of the cosmic inflation event, where the universe would even be bigger than that. And so people say, well, how big is the universe of today? The figure that's bandied around most is it's probably somewhere around 800 or 900 billion light years across. It could be smaller. It could be bigger. Some models even say it could be infinite. Now, it's finite in age, but some models actually permit the space to go out. And it's basically on the geometry. The geometry measures to be flat. If the universe is flat, the space goes out to infinity. If it's spherical, then it's finite. If it's hyperbolic, it goes out to infinity as well. And it measures to be flat to about four places of the decimal. And actually, that's what you'd want if you want life in the universe. So yeah, it's bigger than the billions of light years that we can see. But back to this question about the analogy, how everything in the universe is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional universe. I find it interesting. It talks about how he stretches out the heavens, expands the universe like a thin cloth, and spreads them out like a tent to live in. Now, people have made the point, maybe this isn't exactly what the text is saying, but it is consistent with the idea that the reality of the universe is a surface. And just like a tent is a surface material, a thin material, and the reality of the tent is a surface, now it's inside, now it's outside. And people say, well, what's the universe expanding into? It's expanding into nothing. Beyond the space surface of the universe is nothing. Inside the space surface of the universe is nothing. You say, well, what's out there? Well, just wait. The space surface will expand and get there. But beyond the space surface is nothing. Interior, there's nothing. It really is kind of like a thin cloth, like a tent, spread in such a way that human beings can live within the universe. So it's possible that you might even take this beyond just a mere metaphor to literally speaking about the shape of the universe. Yes. No. The 11 texts that talk about the universe expanding show up in all three Hebrew verb forms. This has come up in a number of debates I've had, especially with Michael Shermer, the Skeptic Society, not far away from here. He's been making the point that they're all in the present tense. They're not. It's in all three Hebrew verb forms, and basically making the point that God created the universe with the property that would guarantee that it would continue to expand. So the fact that we see it in all three Hebrew verb forms means these are more than just figures of speech. The Bible literally is speaking about the universe expanding. Incidentally, this came up in my debate with Peter Atkins. He said, well, you're just reading this into the Bible because you know this stuff is true from your knowledge of astronomy. Who'd said this before Big Bang came along? And I said, well, lots of Jewish theologians actually saw Big Bang cosmology in the Old Testament 800, 900, 1,000 years ago. So it's not just 21st century astronomers that are reading this into the text. Okay, got a few more minutes. Let's go on to another passage. Yes.
Heavens from the left to the right, from horizon to horizon, stretching out an arm and saying, God stretches this out, but not, and we can't even read into Natal, a continual expansion that's ongoing. And as we discuss this, that's what I think I'll bring to the discussion is, what do we do with participles? What do we do with Bob consecutive verbs attached to this participle? and how do we look at syntax and semantics and really etymology of Natal itself to stretch? I think God is a stretcher, but keeps it stretched. He's actively holds the universe in place, just as he sits on the circle of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And this verse is wonderful in that all of the action words except one are participles. And so participles, they become very important. But even more important, and I'll sort of summarize this, is that God expanding to expand even attached to rakia, or is it God stretching a limited left to right? That's hard to tell from the participle, and it really is. But when we look at the word Natal and its etymology, not many people have done that and brought that to the conversation. And it's surprising
okay.
Natal will do it.
Yeah. One of the articles we have on our website, you'll see John Ray's name along with my name on it.
Yes.
Okay. That's the one that goes, I think I included that in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. I put that one in because it's the more technical article on these 11 texts. And I was reluctant myself to, I saw this in the text when I was reading as a teenager. How far can you push it in terms of Big Bang cosmology? But it was John Ray who came to me and said, I've done a big study on this. It's a lot more secure than you may think. And he's the one that worked with me to write the original piece where we talked about the verb nata, how it's used in all 11 texts. And if I recall the details, 9 verbs are in the active participle form. The others are in the perfect or the imperfect form. And he was the one that worked with me and said, it's the fact that it shows up in these 3 different forms that tells us that, yes, God designed the universe with the property of cosmic expansion, but in addition to that is something that ongoes. So, you can take a look at that text because he's the one that basically works through all the Hebrew details. And also the fact that, you know, it's not just people in the 21st century that saw this. But I will concede, this is debated. I mean, we have our debate with our friends of BioLogos, for example. They insist this has got nothing to do with the expansion of the universe, but it's the same group of people who say, we don't think the Bible says anything about cosmology whatsoever. And so I think it's pretty clear, I think you would agree, it is saying something about cosmology. And yeah, there's a debate about how far we can push it. I think there's a debate, for example, on what can we do with this tent analogy. Where did I have that here?
Can I respond to John Ray? I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Good guy, translator of the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good Hebrew scholar. So.
On,
yeah.
But, so I can't contact him by email.
One day you will.
but I do contact other people by email on this. I've gone to Fuller to ask their Hebrew professors on the call participles, which is active.
Right, right.
And we must, for people here who are not into Hebrew or linguists, we must know that call active participle talks about voice, not about tense or perspective. It's a voice that the subject is active.
Right.
Now that can be in any past, present, or future. And so we need to look at what active means. It doesn't automatically mean that it's ongoing expanding.
Yeah, well, that's true because unlike English, Hebrew doesn't have the equivalent of English, tenses. You know, a lot of scholars have pointed out it's not tensed like the way the English language is. So, you're right, John Ray is not available to talk to you right now. But when I did meet with him, I was impressed that he was fluent in biblical Hebrew. I mean, he is a very good Hebrew scholar, and he's not alone in drawing these conclusions. He consulted with a number of his peers at Grace Theological Seminary. So, and the fact is, I mean, there are people long before the 20th century who saw the same point in the text. His comment to me was, if it was only one verse, I'd be hesitant. But the fact that we have 11 texts, he finds that very compelling. But yeah, I do admit it's being debated. as part of the debate we're having with our friends of Biologos.
Steve, you've only got like 3 minutes left.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. Let's at least make progress on this passage. Look up and see who created these. Who brings out the starry host by number? He calls all of them by name because of his great power and strength. Not one of them is missing. Now, for those of you who have been with the class for a while, do you remember another passage we looked at, a creation text that talked about God numbering the stars? Anybody remember that? Psalms, right? No, it wasn't Psalm 19.
Psalm 4.
Psalm 147.
Psalm 147.
Basically making the point that God knows the name of every single star. This is basically making the same point. He calls them by name. Because of his great power and strength, not one of them is missing. Well, stars are like human beings. They form, they burn for a while, and then they die. But this point is making... God knows what each star is going through. And yeah, stars that are, quote, stopped burning, they're still around. God knows where they are. None of them are missing. And how many stars are there in the universe? Or I should ask you another question. You ever heard of the star registry where for $54 you could name the star after a loved one? Okay. I'd probably counsel you not to spend the $54. Because the truth is, you could name 7 trillion stars after every human being and not run out. And here's another question. How many stars on the star registry are recognized as legitimate names by the International Astronomical Union?
Zero.
So you're spending $54 for nothing. But they do give you a nice little map. This shows you where your star is. So, but I think you can come up with a map for a little less than $54. So if you really want to impress, hey, if you really want to impress your honey, just tell her, I can name 7 trillion stars after you. Okay, not just one star. No, let's go all out here, okay? But the whole point here is, God has a name for every star. This is making the point. God has a purpose for every star. Evidently, everyone serves a particular person. He cares for each star. And I tell people, a star is simply a giant ball of hydrogen and helium gas. A human being is a lot more than a giant ball of gas. Okay? A human being is not just... I probably shouldn't have gone there with that one. Sorry. I slipped into that one, so. Right. I got into trouble once and somebody was misunderstanding what I said about gas giants. So.
We're out of time.
We're out of time. Good thing. Let me wrap this up. Father in heaven, we do thank you that you're a God that knows every little speck of dust in the universe, every drop of water, every star. Lord, each one of them is something you care for. Each one of them plays a role in making possible our existence here on planet Earth. And Father, if you know the name of every star, if you care for every speck of dust in the universe, every drop of water in the universe, how much more must you care for each of us human beings? Thank you, Lord, that you created this enormous universe so that we could be here today. Help us, Lord, to find the purpose you've put in place. For every star, for every speck of dust, for every drop of water. But more than that, Lord, help us to discover the purpose for why you created us and what role we need to serve in the few decades we have here on planet Earth. Thank you, Lord, for giving us such an incredibly fulfilling career as a follower of you. And Lord, I pray that you would assist us throughout these next few days and weeks to bring many to know you as Lord and Savior so that all of us can find purpose in a meaningful, eternal life with you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. Thank you.
Good job.
Thanks.
Do you think John MacArthur is older or newer?
Oh, he's younger.
But yet he